already sorry now appears in the following publications. The person who's really responsible for doing all the work is a brilliant former PhD student, a student of mine, Daniel Yates. This work also involves collaborations with a former NYU postdoc, Yona Lemonic, and also outside collaborators such as Fabian Essler, who's at Oxford, and Sasha Abanov, who's at Stony Brook. So as you noticed in my title, I'm talking about edge modes. So the spin chains I'm talking about are really those which have a free or exactly solvable limit in which they are related to topological insulators. In fact, asymmetry protected topological insulators. So to get the talk going, I will introduce you or remind you what a symmetry protected topological insulator is. The wiki definition of a symmetry protected topological insulator is the following, that two distinct SPT phases are those that cannot be smoothly deformed into each other without undergoing a phase transition, as long as this deformation preserves the symmetry. If you allow these deformations to break some under the symmetry, then indeed you can go from one SPT phase to another without a gap closing. So to give you a concrete example, let me say I have one SPT phase, which corresponds to, say, a churn insulator, which you are number one, and it's spatially separated from another churn insulator, which you are number zero. Then the only as I go from the churn insulator one state to the churn insulator zero state, I'm forced to have a phase transition, which corresponds to a gap closing and appearance of these chiral edge modes. So a general feature of all SPT phases is that you put two of them together, and if I'm preserving the symmetry, the boundary of them will hold edge modes. So what are the symmetries one talks about here? Well, the symmetries here are very general symmetries in the sense that they cannot be gotten rid of easily. There are symmetries like whether the system has time reversal symmetry or not, whether it has particle hole symmetry or not. And then from the combination of the two, you can construct a third symmetry. This is a chiral symmetry, where there is a unitary operator with respect to which the Hamiltonian anticommutes. So you have 10 different possibilities corresponding to this Alphonsen-Bauer classification scheme. And basically, by now, we all kind of know about this periodic table of the Alphonsen-Bauer classification scheme, where you first were given a system or a Hamiltonian identifier, whether you have one or more of these symmetries. So that will give you one of these 10 families. Then find out, determine whether you, which spatial dimension you are in. And then this table tells you if there's a non-zero entry, that means non-trivial topological phases are allowed. And if there is a zero there, that means no known topological phases are known to exist. So again, just a reminder, the well-known topological phases here that you read about in textbooks is if you are in spatial dimension d equal to 2 and there's absolutely no symmetry in the problem, then this is the integer quantum Hall effect. Again, there's another famous example with corresponding to spatial dimension d equal to 1 and only having a chiral symmetry. This is this famous Shushi-Fahiga model known since the 70s. And then the topic of this talk is spatial dimension d equal to 1 and class BDI. This is the symmetry that one has here is time reversal, but even under time reversal, particle hole, but even under particle hole. And from the combination of the two, you can construct a chiral symmetry.
Can I ask
So,
a question here?
sure, of course.
Yeah, just going back to the integer quantum Hall effect.
Yeah.
So there are no symmetries. So how, from this perspective, how should I think of stability of the integer quantum Hall effect? From the, you know, it has no symmetries. So then why is it non-trivial from this perspective?
I mean, you can, you are, what it means is that,
It has particle
I mean, you
conservation.
don't, sorry?
It just has particle conservation, I guess that's.
Yes, it does have only particle conservation. That's true. But I mean, this number z can include zero. So that would mean that you have just an ordinary system with no time reversal, no chiral, and no
I see.
f. That's what it means. It includes z equal to zero, which would be probably most of the systems that you have. That's how general you should read this table, how generally you should read this table.
What is Z? So there's a Z. Oh, I see.
Z is
Sorry.
an integer.
Z are integers. Okay, but right. So I mean, this table doesn't explain why integer quantum Hall effect is non-trivial, even though it has no symmetries. You know, it tells you that it's distinct from other phases that you maybe have time reversal invariants, but you know, they have other symmetries. But
what it does tell you is that if you have a system with a non-zero Z and another system with a zero Z, then the boundary of it will have to support edge mods.
Right, but it's unclear what symmetry.
I mean, what it means is that if you have a magnetic field applied in the sample so that you've broken T, as you go from the center of the sample to outside it, the magnetic field shouldn't be going to zero, right? Because then you're breaking, then in the sample you have time reversal, whereas outside you don't have time reversal. That's what it.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. That's probably not central to your talk, but okay.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with you that this quantum Hall effect is such a classic example that when it's presented this way, it's a little bit like a little bit confusing, but
yeah.
Okay, so anyway, so the topic of my talk has to do with this BDI chain where you have, the exactly solvable limit is the Kitaev chain or some generalizations of that. Okay, and I'm going to be particularly interested in the case of flow K driving and then switching on interactions. Right. So to remind you, the Kitaev chain is one where you have spinless fermions with nearest neighbor hopping, on-site chemical potential, and a p-wave pairing. With the Jordan-Wigner transformation, this is equivalent to the famous transverse field-izing model. This chain has two phases, a topologically trivial phase when the chemical potential is larger than the tunneling, and a topologically non-trivial phase when the chemical potential is smaller than the tunneling. And these kind of cartoons must be really familiar to you. So this is a cartoon which is drawn exactly at mu equal to zero, where you know if you put this chain with and cut it at the boundaries, you will find Majorana modes on the left end and right end. If you move away from the mu equal to zero point, these Majorana modes will still be there, except that they will not exactly be the gamma one, but there'll be some linear combination of gamma one and gamma two and gamma three, and similarly for the Majorana mode on the extreme right. So before I go on to flow K case, I want to remind you how to construct the topological invariance of these Kitaev type chains. Let me be a little general and allow for nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor couplings. Such kind of microscopic tweaking of the Hamiltonian actually allows you to make the topological phase diagram a little bit more rich. Now, let me apply periodic boundary conditions and go into momentum space. In momentum space, the Hamiltonian is of the BDG form. It can be written as a pseudo spin sigma coupled to a pseudo magnetic field H. You will notice that this H is just not anything. It has sigma y and sigma z, and is there for a reason, because this model has certain symmetries. One is particle hole symmetry, given by this pointer here, sigma x hbdg star minus k sigma x minus hbdg. This should be sigma x. There's chiral symmetry corresponding to sigma x. This is a typo, because sigma x anti-commutes with hbdg. So these two symmetries, which fall in the so-called BDI class, force the pseudo-magnetic field to lie in the yz plane. And for that reason, the topological invariant is simply the winding of the pseudo-magnetic field h as one goes through the momentum reversal. So here I've taken four pictures from this paper here, where they've allowed for long range couplings, which, as I was saying, that if you allow for a slightly more complicated hoppings, you can make the phase diagram much richer. So you can see you have winding one, then you have these three examples are exactly one winding, and then you have a third winding. This is a topological invariant in the sense that you cannot remove the winding without either breaking the BDI symmetry by, for example, adding the third polymatrix in this Hamiltonian, or by closing a gap, right? So if I add a third polymatrix to this Hamiltonian, you can see that H of k is not no longer going to be in the plane, but it's going to be on the Bloch sphere, in which case it'll be easy to get rid of the winding without closing the gap. So this is just a simple introduction to the topological invariance in the Kitaev chain. Can I just stop and see if there are any questions before I turn to the Floquet version of this? Okay. Well, as long as I've not lost everyone. So now let's go on and look at the Floquet version, right? So in the Floquet version, the Hamiltonian H is now time periodic. H of t plus t is equal to H of t. And you can construct the exact eigenstates, psi. These obey the Floquet-Bloch theorem, namely that after psi of a full drive cycle comes back to itself up to a phase. So therefore I can write psi of t as a pure phase part and one part which is purely time periodic. The pure time periodic part of the wave function is known as a Floquet quasi-mode, and this phase of the wave function can be used to extract a quasi-energy. Okay, so because of this quasi-energy type structure, many of the notions that one knows of from static systems can be generalized, although not everything. There are obviously new exciting things happening with Floquet driving, and I hope I'll get to explain to you why, what's new here. Okay, so let's go back to our Kitaev chain, or generalized Kitaev chain, because I'm allowing for both nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor hopping, and I start periodically driving the system. It doesn't matter what I periodically drive. It could be the pairing, or it could be the chemical potential. So what's plotted here is the quasi-energy spectrum for the open chain, okay? And I'm plotting these results for, again, the special case of just nearest neighbor hopping, even though this Hamiltonian is more general. And on the x-axis is plotted the mean value of the chemical potential, mu naught. First thing to notice is that the quasi-energies have to be plotted within a Floquet-Brillouin zone in order to avoid overcounting of states. And then if you look at the quasi-energy spectrum, it looks a lot like the static system in the sense that there are states here which look like valence band. There are states here which look like conduction band. But the most important thing to notice is that the spectrum is continuous. So the states at omega over 2 and the states at minus omega over 2 are really the same state. And so now you can have two, instead of having one band gap, you can now have two band gaps. And therefore you can also now have two kinds of edge modes, one that reside in the band gap around zero quasi energy and one that reside around the band gap around at the Floquet zone boundary. And one cute thing to notice about these, the Majorana modes is while the one Majorana mode at zero quasi energy has no dynamics, as time evolves, it just doesn't pick up any phase. The Majorana mode that you get at the zone boundary picks up a phase of minus one after one drive cycle. And so it actually has the periodicity of twice a drive cycle. So you can think of it as some kind of a boundary time crystal or something like that. But in any case, the point number one is that you have this extra band gap at the Floquet zone boundary, and therefore an extra set of Majorana modes that can reside at the Floquet zone boundary. And in this particular example, as I go from the extreme left to the right of the plot, you can see that there are at least three different topological phases. There's one where only one Majorana mode exists, and that's at zero quasi energy. Then there is a topological phase transition to one where there is a Majorana mode at zero quasi energy and a Majorana mode at pi quasi energy, and then there is another topological phase transition where there is only one Majorana mode at pi quasi energy. So the question is, how do I think of the symmetries now that are protecting these Majorana modes? So let me go back and look at the Hamiltonian. It is, again, of the BDG form, but it's explicitly time dependent. So we can clearly see, of course, that this Hamiltonian still has particle hole symmetry because sigma x, HBDG star minus k sigma x is minus HBDGK. But what about time reversal? So the issue of time reversal becomes a little bit more subtle when you have time dependence. So the way to recast the whether a time-dependent Hamiltonian is time-reversal symmetric or not is to ask whether the following holds. Is there a time-reversal? The time-reversal operation is one which takes a Hamiltonian at time t and brings you to a Hamiltonian at time tau minus t. If these two are the same, then the system it has effective time-reversal symmetry. So that's the new definition of time-reversal symmetry. And whether you have that or not depends upon how you drive. So for example, if I have a simple sinusoidal drive, then indeed it has that property that h at t and h at tau minus t are the same as shown here. And you can see the appearance of some special times at which the Hamiltonian looks locally time reversal symmetric. These are the time reversal invariant points where t and tau minus t are the same. So it's in that sense that you have to adapt the notion of time reversal symmetry in flow case systems. If I was driving the system with both a sine and a cosine, then I would have lost this property of the drive and there would have been no effective time reversal symmetry. So I manifestly choose this kind of a driving where there are these special time reversal symmetric points T star where the Hamiltonian looks locally time reversal, like it has time reversal symmetric. And if you can construct the topological invariance as follows. So just solve for the exact eigenmodes of the system, the flow k quasimodes. What you will find is that if I'm just looking at the flow k quasimodes at some arbitrary time, because the system doesn't have any effective time reversal symmetry, these flow k quasimodes sit on a Bloch sphere. But at these special times t star, the flow k quasimodes are lying completely in one plane. And from the winding of those flow k quasimodes at these special time reversal symmetric points, you can get a topological invariant. So again, the red line here is just probably my very bad way of drawing that there is no special time reversal symmetric property of at this particular time, and the flow k quasimodes therefore don't have any winding. But there are some special times here corresponding to T star where these flow k quasimodes lie completely in a plane, and then you can extract a winding from them and therefore the corresponding topological invariant. So in particular, if my quasi-energy spectrum had Z naught, zero modes in Z pi modes being these Majorana modes that reside at the flow k zone boundary, then it turns out that the winding at this time reversal symmetric point is z naught minus z pi, and the winding at this time reversal symmetric point is z naught plus z pi. So,
Aditi,
yes.
So just to make sure, this time reversal is a unitary operator?
It's an anti-unitary. So in a static case, you would just do h of minus t is equal to h of t, right? Or any t. But in the time dependent case, this only holds if you do this, if you look at reflections around some special time tau.
Okay, so the chiral symmetry that was discussed in that paper, that's also an anti-unitary symmetry? Or?
No, chiral symmetry is a unitary operator. Right. When you have two anti-unitary symmetries, you can combine them to get a unitary operator. And though it's called a symmetry, it's a unitary operator with which the Hamiltonian anti-commutes.
Okay.
I think Steve had a question.
One question here is bulk invariant, you said that it is defined at T star only.
Yes.
So like in the In that case, we had zero and pi edge modes pinned. So those are anomalous edge modes which are even there when system is topologically non-trivial. People have shown that, like, even when C the winding number is zero, then also we have this zero and pi edge modes. So is it that, like, at T star we can still get the number this bulk boundary correspondence using this bulk invariant for zero and pi edge modes?
Wait, so let me just understand the question a little bit. So one thing, of course, I want to be clear is that you can construct topological invariance for the bulk, right? Like we did in this example. There is no boundary to speak of, but you take a bulk and you get this winding, and it gives you information on what will happen if I put a boundary, period. Now I'm talking about, so I want to do something similar, right, for the flow K problem. And I'm just trying to explain that it's a little bit more subtle. But firstly, because you have two integers that show up when you open the chain. So the question is, how do I extract those two integers from a bulk calculation? Okay.
Okay. Okay.
And now so what I'm trying to say is that let's do a bulk calculation. Momentum is conserved. What you'll find is that at the flow kick quasi modes, they are evolving in time, right? So at any given time, I can look at the flow kick quasi modes all over the Brillouin zone, and I'll see no that I can't get a winding because it's not in a plane. But if I drive in a way which is called time reversal symmetric, which I tried to define in the previous slide, then you'll find that there are some special times, which are the time reversal symmetric points, where you can get the flow K modes to wind. So, and those windings are related to the number of edge modes you see when you put open boundary conditions and see at the edges. And this is actually very beautiful work. This is not my work. This is beautiful work done in this paper, 2014.
Okay, so one can even predict the number of edge modes for pinned at zero and pi quasi energy.
Exactly, because what will happen is, if you have only a zero mode, you'll find that T star here is say one. And then at T star here, you have winding one, okay?
Okay, thank you.
But if I have a zero and a pi mode, then the winding is going to change in such a way that it's the difference between the number of zero and pi modes at one time reversal symmetric points and the sum of the zero and pi modes at the other time reversal symmetric points.
Okay. So I see Steve raised his hand, so go ahead, Steve.
Hi, just one more question about this time reversal symmetry. So you mentioned sine and cosine. So do you mean if sine and cosine are multiplying two different non-commuting operators in the Hamiltonian? Yeah, okay, just checking. Thank you.
Then you would not have time reversal, in which case Z will go to Z2. Yes, thank you for the question. Any other questions here?
Yeah, can you say physically, how should I think of this extra zero mode, the pi mode? Is it like a gap rather than being at zero energy? So it has time dependence. It's oscillating at half the drive frequency.
Yeah. I mean, the way to see it for me, the clearest way is that you are forced to have spectrum is continuous here, right?
Right. Just
so if I now, and if I open up a gap here, then I can have an edge mode, but it's going to be pinned at this point for the same reason as a zero mode is pinned, because if the system has a particle hole symmetry, so E goes to minus E, right? So this zero mode goes back to itself, and the pi mode goes to minus pi, which is the same thing.
I see. But I'm just trying to get a feel for it in time domain, like.
So the time domain is very interesting. So when you look at the quasi-energy spectrum, it's just telling you what's going to happen on an average. To see what's happening in the time domain, you have to make a cut in the wave function, and look at what's happening at the entanglement cut. And there at the entanglement cut, you'll see the zero mode and the pi mode. And the pi mode has its characteristic micro motion, where it picks up a phase of minus one after one time period and comes back to itself after two time periods.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. But I'll come to the entanglement thing in more detail later. Okay, so so constructing topological invariance for with a drive is a little bit more subtle, but nevertheless, the fact that the moment you drive the system and you introduce this additional band gap here at the Floquet-Brillouin zone, at which an additional edge mode can live, immediately tells you a very general thing about going from the Arjlan-Zinbauer table for static free fermions to the Arjlan-Zinbauer table for Floquet free fermions. Namely that in general, if Z is the topological invariant for the static case, then under periodic driving, you get Z cross Z if the driving is going to preserve time reversal symmetry, or Z2 cross Z2 if it breaks time reversal symmetry. This has been a very active topic of research, and these are some of the papers who've discussed this. So question now is, as I think Leo was asking, was what would I actually see? I mean, and where should I even look for these topological invariants? So ultimately at the end of the day, you're given a wave function, and when you're doing Floquet driving, there's no such thing as a ground state. And so if there's a way, given a wave function, you can tell whether it has any non-trivial topology, that would be great. And indeed, you can do that. This has also been a very active area of study. So let's say I have a wave function psi. The simplest thing to do is to find out the bipartite entanglement entropy. So imagine splitting the system spatially between regions A and B and taking the trace over region B, ending up with a reduced density matrix for region A. With the reduced density matrix, you can do two things. One is that you can find the spectrum of the reduced density matrix. It looks a lot like the spectrum of a Hamiltonian, and then you can find the entanglement entropy. Now, if you have an SPT phase, a static SPT phase, then we know it's a kind of a, I mean, for all intents and purposes, like a boring insulator. So what it means is that if I look at the entanglement entropy, it just shows area law. So you have to do a little bit more work to get topological properties out of it. And that involves looking at the entanglement spectrum. So again, very active area of study here. You can look at the reduced density matrix, find its spectrum. And indeed, it turns out that the bulk boundary correspondence that one sees in the Hamiltonian also appears in the reduced density matrix. Provided the wave function that you started with was the corresponded to the half-filled state, a half-filled ground state of the corresponding SPT phase. If you drive it out of equilibrium, what happens is also an interesting topic of study, and hopefully I'll be able to touch upon that topic a little bit. So now, what we wanted to do is, let's look at these Floquet Kitaev chains and see what the entanglement entropy and the reduced density matrix would look like. And so what we did is we took the wave function and put periodic boundary conditions, so it has no knowledge about edge modes. And then you make a cut here, as shown in this picture, take the trace over the outside region and get the reduced density matrix for A. I'm still talking about free fermions, so you can use this trick, which appears in Peschel and Iser, which says that the entire reduced density matrix can be constructed if I just from the two-point correlation functions. So all we did is we constructed the two-point correlation function in subregion G, and after some manipulations, you can get the entanglement entropy of system A, and also the entanglement spectrum. So here's what you see. I'll first show you what happens for the static system before I turn to the Floquet case. So static system, just to orient you, this is the top panel here is the quasi, is the energy spectrum of just the Hamiltonian. The middle panel here is the entanglement spectrum now. And you can see the remarkable similarity. This is again, just showing in plots, the feature I already said that the bulk boundary correspondence of the original Hamiltonian is shared by the reduced density matrix. So as I go from extreme left to extreme right, I go from trivial to a phase which has two myonamoles to one which has one to trivial again. And you see the exact same phase transition happening in the entanglement spectrum. Again, I have constructed a wave function coming from filling up the valence band completely and keeping the conduction band empty. If I look at the entanglement entropy, it looks more or less boring except for these cusps where the bands close, and these cusps are also very well known. These are topological phase transitions where the critical state has a logarithmic scaling of the entanglement entropy with a prefactor which knows about the edge modes. So if the difference in edge modes between the left and right side of the topological phase transition is Z naught, then the prefactor of this log knows about it. It's proportional to that difference. Basically, the number before the log is telling you how many Fermi points are appearing at the topological phase transition. So, okay, so you have a wave function, you look at it and you cut it, you look at it, what's happening at the boundary, and you'll know whether there are edge modes that way. And if I look at exactly the critical point will even tell me how many, what is the difference between the number of edge modes on one side and the other side of the critical point. Okay, so let's do the same with the Floki case. The only problem is that I don't know what wave function to use for the Floki case. The natural wave function is that you prepare a half-filled system with some initial state, and you just time evolve it with the Hamiltonian, the Floki Hamiltonian, and then you do the drill that I just explained. Look at the entanglement entropy and the entangled spectrum. But I'm going to do something simpler right now. I will just take the wave function to be a slated determinant corresponding to occupying all negative quasi-energy states, keeping all the positive quasi-energy states empty. We call this the Floki ground state because for that particular filling, this is the least entangled state that you can construct. So with that state, if I look at the entanglement spectrum and what these different lines are, is that now everything is time dependent. So I'm plotting the entanglement spectrum at different times within a drive period. And the lowest plot here is the entanglement entropy at different times. The topmost is just the quasi-energy, so there's no time dependence. So what you do see is, again, the question that was being asked is what's happening with time? What you'll see is that following the quasi-energy spectrum, the entanglement spectrum also shows a similar structure. It goes from trivial to non-trivial, where there are a certain number of quasi-energy Majorana modes, but the number of Majorana modes are changing in time. So if I watch what's happening carefully here, it's only at those two time reversal symmetric points will I have Majorana modes at exactly zero entanglement energy, which in one time it's z0 plus z pi, at the other time it's z0 minus z pi. But at all other times, there's no time reversal protection. So the Majorana modes, which are spatially located, will hybridize and open up a gap. So that's what you're seeing here. At other times, they're hybridizing and opening up a gap, but there's special times they're again, not are decoupled and getting stuck at zero entanglement energy. So this is what you see. And then if you look at the entanglement entropy, what you find is that it is also fluctuating in time, changing in time, and it has a cusp. This cusp has the same logarithmic scaling with system size. But what's really nice is that this leading behavior is time independent, okay? So all this time dependence is only giving subleading correction to the entanglement entropy. But the leading behavior is time independent and is proportional to effective central charge, which is as follows, z naught minus z naught prime plus z pi minus z pi prime over 2. In other words, what it's doing is intuitively what you expect, that at these topological phase transitions, the prefactor of the log is simply counting the number of Fermi points that now appear at 2 points. There are Fermi points appearing at zero quasi energy, and there are Fermi points appearing at pi quasi energy. And so, so that's what's determining the log here. And any of this micro motion are just giving subleading corrections. Any questions so far right now?
Sorry, Aditi,
yes.
If I may ask a question. So if you pick a generic time, you said entanglement spectrum is gapped.
Yeah. Because what's happened, let's say I have 2 Majorana modes
right.
in my quasi-energy spectrum.
Yeah.
Then what is happening is that at any generic time, the Hamiltonian is not, doesn't have any time reversal symmetry associated.
Right. So nonetheless, those modes,
So those two modes just couple, and when that happens, you know, you have one mode going up and the other mode going down, and there's a gap opening.
But that logarithmic term, the peak,
the peak
persistent peak. All time.
This peak is appearing, pardon me? So this peak is now appearing at the topological phase transition when it's gapless.
And
so remember where
this
peak is coming. The peak is coming in the same situation as in the static case, right? When you're in the topological phase, then it's just area law entanglement. But when you're at the topological phase transition, then it's at all times there are the system is gapless.
So if you tune the mu into that critical value and look at the entanglement spectrum as a function of time.
Yes.
Does it remain gapless at all time or?
Yeah, so that's the point. So there's always going to be a gapless part, and then there'll be other things which will, it's not like it is not changing in time. The leading behavior is going to come from these Fermi points, these gapless points, which give the log. But there's still some time dependence even at the, everywhere. So that, but those are only giving you subleading corrections because, you know, imagine, look at it this way, that all the time dependence is coming from a scale which is of the order of the drive frequency, and you have gapless modes moving with some velocity v. So the distance over which anything is changing is just a short distance physics, and it's not supposed to modify the logarithmic scale. The logarithms are entirely arising because they're Fermi points. So they're Fermi points which are fixed.
Hi, I have one question. Here, like I see that there is zero mode in the quasi energy spectrum, but there is no simultaneous existence of both zero and pi edge modes. Individually, I think am I right? Like zero mode is existing.
Yeah, there is a zero. Or maybe in this example, but there are other examples. Where,
because the entanglement spectrum is predicting very well the number of edge modes, so it's like behaving as a good bulk invariant. But I have seen few papers where in which work. It suggests that when there is a coexistence of zero and pi edge modes, then if both of them exist simultaneously, then it is very difficult to establish that concept of bulk invariant. So
so that is related. I think this will require a little bit more discussion. Maybe I will. You can, it's this, if you have both zero and pi modes, then you can, it is this relation that holds, sorry, I'm now going, it is this one. So what you'll find is that at one time reversal symmetric point, you have these many edge modes, z naught minus z pi. And at the other, you have z naught plus z pi. So by looking at that difference, you can determine how many pi modes there are. By looking at the difference between the number of modes at zero entanglement spectrum. Look at the number of Majorana modes at zero entanglement energy, and look at it at the two different time reversal symmetric points. The amount by which they differ is the number of pi modes.
Okay, thank you.
So, but I'm running out of time because the really exciting thing is putting it in interactions. Sorry. So now let's come to the very important question of robustness. And this is where things get really exciting, because when we started working on this problem, we thought, okay, these zero and pi modes are just very delicate objects. Who knows whether you can construct the so-called flow kick ground state where they appear in this nice, neat way. Because it's quite generically, if I just do unitary time evolution from some initial state, I'll end up occupying all these states in the conduction and valence bands uniformly corresponding to an infinite temperature state, and probably we won't see anything. But it turns out that in Kitaev type models, that's no longer the case. It's not true for all SPD states, but for Kitaev type systems, there's an additional constraints that really makes these edge modes extremely robust. And this is the concept of a strong zero mode. So these gamma operators, the dangling gamma 1 and gamma 8 operators that I showed you of the Kitaev chain are actually an example of what is known as a strong zero mode. A strong zero mode is defined as follows. It is an operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian, and it commutes with a discrete symmetry of the system, for example, fermion parity. It anti-commutes with the discrete symmetry of the systems, which is fermion parity. And moreover, it's a local operator in the sense that if you do psi naught square, it's an operator of norm one. So this immediately implies that if this operator exists, it could be that this operator doesn't exist. But if this operator exists, then the entire spectrum of the system with open boundary conditions is doubly degenerate. So the degenerate pairs are even and odd parity states of the Hamiltonian, where you can go from the even parity state to the odd parity state by the application of this strong zero mode. So that's what's happening in these Kitaev type chains, that the edge modes are really strong zero modes. And because this is an operator identity and a property of the entire spectrum, you can be at infinite temperature and you still see these edge modes. So you can construct these strong modes exactly. So for example, let me start with the classic Kitaev chain or the transfer field Ising model. When mu is zero, then quite trivially, the strong zero mode is just a Pauli matrix X on the first side. You can see right away sigma X1 commutes with H, and it anti-commutes with this fermion parity. But when mu is non-zero, you still have a strong mode, but it's like a Taylor series expansion of Majorana modes or spin operators on the first side, on the second side, and third side, so on and so forth. It's a converging Taylor series expansion. By converging, I mean that if I look at psi naught square, you find that its norm is 1 minus mu over j whole square. And this is perfectly consistent with where we expect the topological phase transition in the Kitaev chain to occur. This topological phase transition occurs at mu equal to j when this operator also stops existing because it's non-normalizable. So this operator actually is a game changer in the sense that it immediately implies that the Pauli operator, Pauli spin on the first site has very long coherence time. So how do I know that this operator exists? There are two ways. One is that you just put open boundary conditions, and you just do exact diagonalization. And if your spectrum ends up looking like it's very close to being doubly degenerate, that means an operator like this exists. Another thing is that if this operator exists, then one of the spins on the first site, say sigma X, sigma Y, or sigma Z, has a strong overlap with it, which means that if I look at its infinite temperature autocorrelation function, and by infinite temperature, you can see it's traced over the entire Hilbert space, sigma X1 of T, sigma X1 of zero, then you will find that this autocorrelation function is extremely long-lived. So in this plot, the blue line is the autocorrelation function of sigma X, whereas the blue, as a green and the yellow ones are the autocorrelation function of sigma Y and sigma Z. Because sigma Y and sigma Z do not have any overlap with the strong zero mode, the corresponding autocorrelation function decays very rapidly, whereas the sigma X1 has an overlap. So you can see it's living for a very long time. And the only thing that's constraining its lifetime is really just the system size. If I make the system size larger, this lifetime will grow. So what I'm trying to say is that if the strong mode exists, you can create a very highly excited state and still you have edge modes. So then the question happens, what happens if you put in interactions? And this has also been an active area of study. And it turns out that with interactions, as long as the interactions are not very strong, you don't ruin things too much in the sense that the strong modes become almost strong modes, in the sense that this mode is almost commuting with the Hamiltonian. And as a result, it does acquire a lifetime, but this lifetime is still very, very long. In particular, this lifetime, if I write it as gamma, so that the autocorrelation function is decaying as e to the minus gamma t, then you look at gamma, you'll find that it's highly non-perturbative in the strength of the interactions. So here I'm putting in an extra interaction, Jz, which is sigma zi plus one. So of course, the natural question is, what happens with flow k? So I have to say that flow k and interactions always seemed like a hopeless situation because it seemed like the system would heat to infinite temperature. And then there's a lot of work which discusses stability of edge modes in flow k chains under the presence of disorder, because the physics is that disorder provides many body localization and that can provide a protection of the edge modes. But what's fascinating is that if you have strong modes, then you do not need disorder. You can be in a clean flow k system and you still have extremely long-lived edge modes. They're not infinitely long-lived, but they're still very long-lived. And this is not because of any high frequency driving, because that's also another regime one often tends to study flow k cases, where you'd say that the frequency of the drive is large as compared to the band gap. And so there is some long time scale, which again stabilizes the modes. No, that's not the case. Almost always when you have pi modes, you are driving resonantly. So you cannot, so this is not any kind of high frequency driving. What one does have, however, are not just zero modes, but pi modes. So that's the nice thing about flow k is that everything gets doubled. So just like you had strong zero modes for the static case, now you have actually two kinds of modes to keep track of, a strong zero mode and a strong pi mode. And how are these defined? Well, to define them, it's better to work with the time evolution over one period, which is the flow k unitary. So a strong zero mode is one which anti-commutes with the discrete symmetry, but now it commutes with the flow k unitary, which ensures that the eigenspectrum of the flow k unitary comes in degenerate pairs, where each pair is even an odd parity. But now if you have a strong pi mode, then this pi mode anti-commutes with discrete symmetry, but it also anti-commutes with the flow k unitary. And that now also ensures that the quasi-energy spectrums are paired, but the pairing is not at the same quasi-energy, but quasi-energies that are separated by pi over t. So that would be another diagnostic if you want to do flow k driving and you didn't know anything and you want to see whether these strong zero modes and strong pi modes exist. You would just exact diagonalize it. If you have pairing at same epsilon, that means there's a strong zero mode. If you have a pairing at epsilon and epsilon plus or minus pi, that means you have a pi mode. And the diagnostic for determining it is in the dynamics is that you look at the infinite temperature autocorrelation function, again, of the operator at the first site. If I have a strong mode, strong zero mode, then the symmetric average between nearest neighbor neighboring stroboscopic times will not change, it'll stay fixed. Whereas if I have a strong pi mode, then the anti-symmetric average between nearest neighbor times will not change. This is because the pi mode has this property that's splitting between one and minus one. Okay. So here is a plot to show how I'm looking at I'm doing a unit, a binary drive again, free fermions, and this one has strong zero mode, middle phase has strong zero and pi modes as shown in this picture, and then the bottommost plot has strong pi modes. And these live for a very long time. The only thing that's setting the time scale is the system size. Okay, but I've always wanted to come to interactions, so let me switch on interactions. So for this, what we look at is a ternary drive. So for one third of the drive, you drive with a local chemical potential. For the second third, you drive with just the sigma xi term. And for the last one third, you have the sigma zi plus one term, right? So if this last term was not there, you just have the free case. But now all of them are present. And what happens is now it's, so recall, these are, I'm going to look at what happens to the analogous phases that I showed in these three plots. What happens is that indeed they do acquire a lifetime, which is shorter than that of the free case, but still it's very long as compared to the drive period, right? So you can see that the lifetime here is 10 to the 3 times the drive cycle. Here it is 10 to the 10, yeah, it's about 10 to the 2 or 10 to the 3 times the drive cycle. It's very long. And what do I mean by long? What I mean by long is that if I compare the autocorrelation function of the edge mode versus the autocorrelation function of a bulk mode, the bulk object has just heated to infinite temperature, so its autocorrelation function just decays within a drive cycle, whereas the autocorrelation function of the strong zero mode or strong pi mode is much more long-lived. So you have these edge modes that are coexisting with a high temperature bulk. And how do I understand it? And since I'm kind of running out of time, first of all, this slide is just saying that this is, I'm not cherry picking data. There are large regions of parameter space corresponding to these black regions where you find these almost strong zero and pi modes existing. So this is not some special cases. And so what we wanted to come up with an understanding for what's setting the time scale. And so what we did is we adapted a method known as the recursion method, which is very popular, has been very popular recently in understanding how operators spread, to the case of the edge mode operator. So what is the recursion method? The recursion method is the following. So we see that the Heisenberg time evolution of an operator can be written this way, where L is the Liouvillean, it's L acting on O is commutator of H with O. So the Heisenberg time evolution can be written as some series involving successive application of the Liouvillean on the operator that you're interested in studying. In the recursion method, what one does is that you basically map the Heisenberg time evolution to that of a free particle in a Krylov basis. How does this mapping work? It's as follows. It's really quite simple. So let's say, so first thing to note is that states, you can define a Hilbert space of states, but you can also define a Hilbert space of operators, okay? So now let's imagine a state which is corresponds to the operator on the very first site. So this is going to be my first state in this so-called Krylov basis. Then you act on L on this operator sigma x1, which means you commute sigma x1 with H, you get a new operator. The overlap of this new operator with the one you started with is known as a Lanczos coefficient B1. In this hopping model, it's basically just going to be the amplitude of hopping from the first state to the second state. After you obtain the second operator, you should orthogonalize it with the previous operator. And then you just repeat the process. Now on the new operator, you again apply L on it, means find its commutation with the Hamiltonian. Its overlap with the previous operator is my new Lanczos coefficient. And then you Gram-Schmidt orthogonalize this operator with the previously obtained operator. So all these orthogonal operators are what form a Krylov basis. And the amplitude of going from one basis vector to the other are these Lanczos coefficients. And basically, once I have these Lanczos coefficients, my infinite temperature time evolution is simply e to the ILT 1-1. Now I'm making it sound very easy, but you have to remember that these, to get any meaningful information, depending on how fussy you are, you need many of them. And this is where the problem becomes, again, system size dependent. You are not trying to avoid the problems that ED has. But the reason why this method is been very popular is that it has been realized that if I just want to ask some general questions about how an operator is behaving, whether it's spreading in the fastest possible way, most chaotic way, or whether it's just spreading like as in an integrable model, then there are some general features of these Bs. So inspired by that, we wanted to see if there are just some general features of these Bs when the operator that we are time evolving is an edge mode operator. So indeed, we found that to be the case. So these are the hopping parameters of the operator on the very first site. which corresponds to, which has an overlap with the strong mode. So the blue line here is the other BNs when JZ is zero. And then as I go from blue to orange to green to red, I'm gradually increasing JZ. So when JZ is zero, you can see that this, this looks like a 1D model, which is like a sushi for either chain. And that's a nice result because it immediately tells you that it gives you an alternate interpretation of these strong modes. These strong modes of the original chain are like the edge modes of the Shu-Shifuhiga model in this Krylov basis. And then when you increase JZ, you can see what JZ tries to do is that it firstly, it tries to decrease the dimerization. And secondly, it increases the slope. By the time you come to the red line, this is a classic profile of the BNs for a operator that spreads chaotically. So this linearly growing BN is something which is known to produce the most, the fastest operator spreading. But what this, what the edge operator is doing is going smoothly from this very stuck state where it's hardly moving or not moving at all to spreading very rapidly as I increase JZ. So what we did is, and then for each of these lines, you can see how the autocorrelation function is changing. So what we did is we then came up with some continuum models for the these kind of lattice systems, because in then going to the continuum, you can then make some calculations for tunneling probabilities and things like that to determine the lifetime of the quasi-energy mode. Okay, so first thing I want to mention is that, okay, so this slide may not be terribly important, so let me skip it. So I'm just saying, let's look at just this slide since I'm almost out of time. So this is painstaking slide obtained by Daniel. What we were trying to argue is the general effective model for the almost strong mode. And the general effective model we came up with was one where you have a slope proportional to JZ. And you have a dimerization, but this dimerization is not fixed in N. It's gradually decreasing in N. So this dimerization here is, for example, HN twiddle, and it is decreasing as some power law of beta. And M naught is the dimerization on the very first side. And what Daniel did on these plots here is that he's really taking the numerical ED data and getting all the parameters from there. And so the idea is that you can see that you can effectively model the dimerization as non-zero up to a certain point and then falling off to zero. These are the blue lines here. So the effective model that we came up with was one where after going into the continuum is that of a Dirac model where the mass is now no longer just constant as you would expect for the continuum limit of the Shu-Shifuhiga model, but something that's fixed up to some point N and then goes to zero. So then you can see how the tunneling amplitude will be computed. Basically, you have an edge mode at N equal to zero, but it's only quasi-stable because this barrier corresponding to the mass is non-zero only up to a finite distance beyond which you just have a pure metal. So you can just compute this gamma here and you find it to be e to the minus m naught, which is the dimerization on the very first side over the slope alpha with alpha given by JZ. Okay, so that is my, this was pretty much my final slide. So I'll just present the conclusion. So what I've shown here is that clean interacting flow case systems, although they heat to infinite temperature, if an almost strong mode is present, edge modes can survive heating for a very long time. And these times exceed the thermalization time for bulk operators by many orders of magnitude. And this is great news for realizing non-abelian edge modes by flow case driving. And what I've proposed here is a way to analytically, a combination of analytics and computation to extract the lifetime of these topological edge modes in a system size independent way. And this method, based on the recursion method, we can also use it to study the stability of edge modes in other spatial dimensions. And it's not special to just static systems. You can also do it for flow case systems. That's it.
Okay, great. Are there questions? Okay, so Sharmishta, go ahead.
So I had a question. Can you please clarify why the autocorrelation goes down when the operator spreading increases?
Autocorrelation.
Yeah, that slide.
So what the slide is showing is that as you increase JZ, when JZ is zero, right, then the strong mode is exactly commutes with the Hamiltonian. That is why it lives for as long as it does. The only thing that's setting its time scale is system size. But when you start increasing JZ, what happens is that the strong mode becomes an almost strong mode. It doesn't exactly commute with the Hamiltonian. So it acquires a lifetime. And the amount of lifetime that it has depends on the strength of JZ. If I crank up JZ, the less the poorer is its commutation with the Hamiltonian, in other words. So, making sense? So as you increase-
What has it to do with this linear slope? I just want to understand the connection between this.
Okay, so then, so now if I was not talking about strong modes, but just a generic operator, then there are some bounds that have been established, not by me, but maybe these authors, and there are also other authors, which say that if these Bs are linearly growing in position, then it gives you the fastest possible operator spreading, the most chaotic operator spreading, which would mean that the autocorrelation function is going to decay in the fastest possible rate.
Mm-hmm.
Operator spreading just means that autocorrelation function is decaying very fast.
Okay, thank you.
Steve, go ahead.
Hey, Aditi, thanks for a very nice talk. So if as you add interactions and the edge mode operator no longer exactly commutes,
yeah.
Is there some intuition for the lifetime and the heating and stuff? Is it because they can tunnel out or because they can dephase and then yet they're still confined on the edge? You see, does that make sense?
Yeah. So our interpretation is that they actually tunnel out because they can eventually hybridize with the bulk modes. Because the bulk is gapless. And there's only a little bit of a barrier which is preventing it from completely vanishing. So.
I see. Okay. I mean, I wonder if that's generic or, you know, for this particular model. It'd be interesting to think if you could find a model where they only dephase but they don't leak into the bulk, or I don't know if such things are possible, but anyway, it's interesting.
Okay.
Yongbek?
Yes.
Sorry, this question may not be directly related to your setup, but for the static case, there's this work by Witkowski and GitHub. If you couple the different chains, then the Z classification changes to Z8.
Yes.
So imagine I'm doing something similar to that in the Flockhead system. Then are there going to be some extra implication for the pi mode, for example, instead of zero mode?
Yeah. There are, of course, implications. I will just point out to the papers that have discussed this.
Oh, okay.
I guess we'll maybe go out and look at this. So interacting case, the Z8 classification of the static case indeed does get enriched for interacting flow case systems. And I wouldn't be surprised with that this is probably the Porter Morimoto Vishwanath paper being one of them. So there are indeed these corresponding animalous modes, even with strong interactions. And of course, I have to mention that they also take care to make sure that you are in the MBL phase so that you don't have an infinite temperature bulk. And so, of course, there's also a similar question there, whether you can have an infinite temperature bulk and still have edge. So that has not been explored.
Okay, okay, thanks.
Hi,
how are you? Thank you for the very nice talk. So for the operator L you defined, my understanding you monitor the dimerization.
Let me see. This is just the Louisvillian, right? L.
Yeah. That's right. So then in the next slide, I think you show the plot where
maybe
some dimerization goes away.
Yes.
But is it possible to compute polarization operator for the Liouvillian rather than dimerization itself?
It would be, I think it should be. We just dipped our toes into this, and it would be interesting to see what the polarization would do. I don't see any reason why not to. It's, at this point, it's just simply a type binding model.
Right, exactly. So then I think for the SSH model,
we
can discuss dimerization, which perhaps disappears at some point, but we can also look at the dimerization. Polarization.
So we haven't looked at it yet.
Okay, thank you.
I should also mention that it is very important that with interactions, not only does the slope get introduced, but the dimerization also reduce. Because if I only introduce a slope and not mess around with the dimerization, I still have edge modes at the boundary. So this may be related to what you're talking about, Steve, because then in that case, you still have edge modes that are sitting there and they might deface because now I have an edge mode here, you see my pointer. And then I have an edge mode here, which is a point where the dimerization effectively looks like it's changing sign. So you still have stable edge modes, but then you have these two modes that are actually talking to each other and hybridizing. And so this may be the partial answer to your question.
So related to that, so suppose you have a semi-infinite line. So in that case, do you have a zero mode?
If I have a semi-infinite line, you mean with no interactions?
With interactions. So within.
Then you have a quasi-stable zero mode.
Even in that case, it become.
With interactions, it is quasi-stable unless you have. There are some fine-tuned points. Like if you are at the XYZ point, then it's again integrable. And Paul Fenley showed that the strong mode, there is a strong mode there. But quite generically, if I just add interactions, then the strong mode becomes almost strong, becomes quasi stable.
So it's not because it hybridized with the other edge point. No.
It's just because you get a system size independent. If you make the system size large enough, you'll get a decay rate which doesn't depend on system size.
But I thought you have a gap between the edge mode with other.
I'm not looking at this in the ground state sector. Remember, I'm looking at this as an infinite temperature sector. So then there is no gap in the bulk to begin with. I'm summing over all states in the Hilbert space. So that's why the bulk is metallic for all intents and purposes. If I was in the ground state sector, then of course there'll be a bulk gap which will protect the edge mode.
Okay. So suppose you prepare your initial state with the ground state of the instantaneous Hamiltonian, at t equals zero, and you time evolve that state. In that case, would you also expect the same thing?
Yeah, so if I time evolve the state and if it's a free fermion state, then that edge mode will be stable forever. But on the other hand, if I'm time evolving the state and their interactions, then that edge mode will be stable only for a certain very long time.
Okay, thank you. Okay. If there is no further question, let's thank Aditi again for the great talk and hope to see you next week.
Thanks. Bye, folks.